Now to corruption of the highest level here in the U.S. A few weeks ago, Steve Fishman's phone rang. He's a contributing editor with New York Magazine, and he's been writing about Bernard Madoff. On a scratchy phone line, calling collect, was Madoff himself. He's now serving 150 years in federal prison in North Carolina for a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme. Madoff wanted to tell his side of the story. He told Fishman that when he first revealed his scheme, his wife Ruth was in shock.
And angry at me, of course. How could she not be angry at me?
Yeah.
You know, she tries not to be, but it's hard not to be. I mean, you know, I destroyed our family.
And Steve Fishman joins me for more on his conversations with Bernard Madoff. You've been working on this article for a while, trying to get Bernard Madoff to get in touch with you from prison, and ultimately he did call you. Why do you think he reached out now?
There are probably several reasons that Bernie reached out to me. One of them was that he has a story that he feels hasn't been told. He, whether it's self-deluded or not, he feels he's been mischaracterized, and he wants to tell that story. I suspect that another reason, perhaps at a less conscious level, was that he has been cut off completely now from a family that he was very close to for years and years. And I almost suspect that he wanted to speak to me as a way of communicating to his family.
He's been cut off from them because, well, in the case of one son, the son has committed suicide. His wife now will not be in touch with him, and his other son has completely broken off ties with him.
That's correct. His remaining son is furious at him. His wife, Ruth, initially stood by him, but now has decided that she can't talk to him.
You open your article in New York Magazine with the anecdote of Bernard Madoff going to see a therapist every week. And according to Bernie Madoff, he asked her, "Am I a sociopath?" What does he claim that he heard back from the therapist?
Well, Bernie was very concerned by this question because he told her that everybody on the outside thinks I'm a sociopath. And she, according to Bernie Madoff, said, "No, you're not a sociopath. You have remorse. You have morals." And then it was later in the conversation that Bernie added, "To me, I am a good person."
You know, as I read and listen to the audio of these phone calls, it doesn't strike me that Bernard Madoff is filled with remorse. I'm not hearing the voice of a man who regrets a lot of what he did. Were you hearing that?
I did hear that. I heard words to that effect. Now, remorse is a complicated thing in Bernie Madoff, and I don't think that he is prepared to shoulder certainly not all of the blame. And to some extent, it's true that he minimizes his part in it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. Bernard Madoff in these conversations seems to have an odd combination of some level of regret, but also disdain for some of the investors who gave him tons of money over the years. Let's listen to some of what he told you.
Did I make a lot of money for people? Yeah. I made a lot of money for people. You know, did people lose profits that they thought they made? Yes. You know, but did they lose capital? I'm sure, I'm confident that when this thing is all finished, very few people, if any, will lose their principal.
So he seems to be saying there, look, they'll get their money back through the trustee that's looking into all this.
Bernie follows his case very closely in the newspapers, and his calculation is that people will get back their principal, the money they invested, which if you look at the trustees' figures may actually be right. Now, I don't think it's a straight line from there to feeling like this is no big deal. I don't think that Bernie Madoff fully understands the level of destruction, the level of havoc that he's caused in people's lives.
I was looking through some of the comments on New York Magazine's website, and one of them said this: Madoff is a pathological liar. You facilitate his falsehoods by publishing this unsubstantiated view of his, quote, early career. I wonder how Bernard Madoff's victims would read what you've written here and if they would get any comfort from it at all.
I think his victims will be furious, and rightly so. He told me at one point, he said, listen, a lot of my... And I'm paraphrasing here. But he said, listen, a lot of my victims are going to tell you that they're living out of dumpsters now. And I'm sure that it's awful for some of them, but not many of them were net losers. I can't imagine that his victims will be happy to read that.
Steve Fishman, contributing editor for New York Magazine. His article is titled The Madoff Tapes. Steve, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
One of the things holding up America's economic recovery is the enormous backlog of homes now sitting on the market. David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team has been asking why the housing market is taking so long to sort itself out. The answer may have something to do with a coin toss.
The man with the coin is Eric Johnson, a professor at Columbia's Business School.
Here's a coin, real American currency.
Johnson is not an economist. He's trained in psychology. And he says one reason the housing market gets stuck on the way down has to do with this weird way our brains think about losing compared to winning. He demonstrates with the coin.
I'm going to flip it in the air. If it comes up heads, you win $6. If it comes up tails, you lose a dollar. Do you want to play that gamble?
If it comes up heads, I win $6?
Yes.
If it comes up tails, I lose $1?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, good.
He keeps pushing. Heads, I win $6. Tails, I lose $2. Sure. Lose $3. Okay.
What happens if we say now, heads, you win $6. Tails, you lose $4.
I'm less enthusiastic about that.
And what most people do is at that point, or at the point before it, they switch.
Switch and say, no, I won't take that bet. And yet, as one economist told me, if you don't take that bet, you shouldn't be doing any investing at all. Mathematically, that is an awesome investment. Half the time it's heads, half the time it's tails, but the amount you win is more than the amount you can lose. Yet somehow, it doesn't feel that way. And that's if you play once.
Just imagine you were going to play that 1,000 times. You'll end up with a pretty nice chunk of cash.
You'd win, on average, $1,000. Still, a lot of people won't take that bet. I went out on the street to test it out on random people. Here are Lisa Marie Elliott and Frank Blake. Heads, you get $15. Tails, you lose $10. Would you take that?
No. No, I wouldn't. I don't want to give up $10. There's a chance I might have to.
What about you?
I'm on the same page. $15 makes no difference in my life as far as gaining it, but losing the 10 in my pocket does.
And what does risk-averse Frank Blake do for a living?
I'm a stuntman.
A stuntman. Yes, car crashes, jumping through windows, that stuff. Eric Johnson says what this coin toss experiment demonstrates is that in our brains, we feel losses and gains differently. Losing feels worse than winning feels good. So now, as promised, back to housing. This is one reason the housing market is taking so long to sort itself out. In a down market, people don't want to sell, because when they actually sell, it feels like losing.
Psychology matters a lot in understanding economic behavior.
This is Chris Mayer, professor of real estate at Columbia Business School. He found real evidence for this fear of losses when he studied the Boston condo bubble in the 1980s. He would compare two basically identical condos. The owners had both paid off their mortgages, but one had bought at the peak of the market. And that person, he found, would stubbornly ask for a higher price and keep it on the market longer than the other person, who had no dreamy memory of the boom days when it was worth a lot more.
The overall magnitude of this effect is very big. Most people believe that this is an important factor in how housing markets operate.
There are certainly other reasons the housing market is taking so long to sort out. Some people are stuck financially with their mortgages. But this psychological quirk is also slowing the healing process. Again, Eric Johnson.
It's sort of like having a Band-Aid where you know you'd be better off if you just pull it off all at once. But instead, what you do is you tend to pull it off very slowly, if at all.
It's unclear why our brains are wired this way, why we overemphasize losses. Johnson says it could go back millions of years to when losing a bet was way more serious, when we were avoiding animals that wanted to eat us. Today, we're selling houses, but part of our brains may still be thinking about the leopards in the trees. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
More All Things Considered coming up right after this. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And we're going to spend some time talking tablet computing in this week's installment. Less than a year after Apple started a touchscreen tablet revolution, the company is already set to release the next generation of the iPad. iPad 2 is supposed to debut this week. Meantime, HP, Samsung, and Motorola are just beginning to offer similar machines. Donald Bell covers tablets for CNET.com, and he joins us now to talk about all of this. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, before we get to some of the iPad competitors, what are some of the new features that Apple might roll out with this new iPad 2?
The pretty obvious new features are going to be thinner, it's going to be lighter, it's going to have a camera, probably a front-facing camera so that people can do video chat. But beyond that, I don't think Apple has to do a whole lot to keep their lead and keep people interested.
We mentioned a few, but tell me about some of these other tablets and what they might offer.
Well, the biggest competitor to Apple on the tablet front is Google, and they don't make a tablet specifically, but they make an operating system called Android that is on a lot of these devices. The manufacturers, Samsung has a tablet in the race. Motorola has a new one called the Zoom that I just reviewed last week. And then there's a lot of smaller competitors that take that Android operating system and they put them on really inexpensive tablets that aren't great to play with, but they can compete.
Do they all have basic features? Are they all touch screen tablets? Can you expand the image in the way that you can in an iPad if you turn it around? Does the image sort of follow you as you turn the tablet around?
Yeah, and it's a lot of follow the leader. A lot of people know that you know they need to make something that is as like the iPad as possible, but still put their own unique spin on it.
You know, the iPad is basically a platform. The reason that it is as successful as it is or has been embraced as broadly as it has been because of all the applications. You can basically use your iPad to do all kinds of things if you are able to, you know, load it up with all kinds of apps. Can you do that with these other tablets?
Not to the point that you can with the iPad. I mean, when they're advertising the iPad or even the iPhone to a certain extent, they're just showing off the apps. They're not even showing off the phone's features anymore at this point. They're just kind of showing off all the fun stuff you can do with apps. And they've got, the last quote was around 60,000 apps just made for the iPad, for the larger screen of the tablet. And right now, Google has finally unveiled their Android 3.0 operating system, which is made for tablets, and are saying that they're ready to start making applications just for that tablet operating system now too. But they're just starting, so there's a lot of catch up involved.
If Apple wants to maintain its first to the market advantage, what will it have to do to stay ahead?
Not much. I'm not necessarily the biggest Apple evangelist, but I do think Apple has done something pretty special with the iPad, which is that they've convinced consumers to buy a product they don't really need. I mean, they've taken smartphones, which is kind of a necessary thing that people need. They've taken laptop computers and traditional desktop computers, and then they've forced them aside a little bit to make a new market of a tablet computer that can kind of straddle both of those, but that there's no precedent for it.
Donald Bell, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, it was wonderful talking to you.
Donald Bell is a senior editor at CNET.com.